Our next speaker is Agnes Pawlowska. Close?
Yes, that's actually quite good.
Oh, wow. And she is a PhD student at the University of Manitoba in the Native Studies Department, a department that we have very good relationship with, and glad to see you on the panel.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here and slightly intimidated by having Dr. Atlio sit right next to me. But I'll try to... And likewise, I guess. my name is Agnes, and I'm a PhD student in Native Studies. I'm, however, not Indigenous. I did get kind of suckered in by Native Studies because somehow when I was younger, I had like a thing for colonialism and neocolonialism, and Native Studies ended up to be an interesting department to be in. So I've been thinking about some of the questions I wanted to talk about and what I wanted to talk about today, and I really couldn't come up with anything coherent, as in having a position. So what I wanted to do was provide you with a little bit of context of some of the things I wanted to say and some of the perspectives I've been seeing and that have been kind of raw to me in the last little while since I began my job. But my background is a PhD, like I said, in Native Studies, and I have been working with Poplar River First Nation. I've been working with them for almost a decade. Please don't count and figure out how old I am, but a decade. And initially, I started working with Poplar River back when the whole Bipole 3 East Side. So I started working with Poplar River at the time when that whole East Side, West Side debate was happening. And I was asked by the community to assist them with some of the oral stories collection. So I thought, hey, this is a great project. I was supposed to be their plan B. Plan A was to have permanent protection on their territory, and plan B, if needed, was to take the government to court, and some of the stories I would have collected and had collected would have assisted the community. And I was really glad to work on this project because it also, not only was it a positive project that I was working on, but it also fit with my personal environmental ethics. However, and this kind of changed for me a little bit when I started working for Fox Lake. Fox Lake is a Cree community in northern Manitoba. And this is pretty much the background that I wanted to provide for you. I met this elder. His name is Noam Hassan, who was actually supposed to be here with me, but he was coming out of a jamboree yesterday and did the midair splits and either broke a leg or sprained the muscle. So he was unable to be here with me to speak on this with me, actually. But I met Noah, and then our friendship eventually became something else. And Noah had asked me to help him apply to be an intervener with the newest project that's going to happen in northern Manitoba, the Kiesk project. So Noah and I have been, I'm the coordinator, the paper person, and Noah's the kind of lead elder that has been involved in this process. And the Kiesk project, to give you a little bit of background, it's another generation, 7-generator hydro dam currently built, well, started to be built, but they're now going through the licensing in northern Manitoba. It will be the 4th dam around Gillam on Makisusakaigan, which is the Fox Lake traditional territory. And it will flood approximately 45 meters square. So Noah and I have been involved in this process for the last couple of months as interveners, we are called, in the hearings, which are currently taking place, which is why I'm wearing a suit, in the city here. And let me tell you a little bit about Noah, actually, before I go along. So Noah is a 70-something-year-old, actually, elder who's still a harvester. So he harvests moose. He harvests caribou. He can actually tell the difference between the four different types of caribou that are out there. And he traps things like muskrat and rabbit still. And he hunts for geese. However, Noah has also is associated and called Kennedy's disease, which is a debilitating kind of disease, which actually doesn't allow him to walk very freely. And I have seen him literally crawl up my stairs to get the three steps to my house in order for us to either have a meeting or look at some maps or something. So I've been involved with Noah doing this grassroots movement, and we've been bringing in other panelists and other activists like Judy De Silva from Grassy Narrows, and then different experts from the universities to present our evidence and our position that the Kiesk project should not be built. And even though Noah is a grassroots individual and he doesn't want the further destruction of his land, especially since the Kiesk project is going to be largely impacting his trap line that he currently still uses, Fox Lake Cree Nation is actually a partner in the Kiesk project. So the Kiesk project is actually a partnership agreement between four Cree nations and Manitoba Hydro. So this is perhaps a different position here because the four Cree nations are actually the proponents of the project. And with Manitoba Hydro, they are arguing for the continuation of this project. And the reason why I thought this would be interesting to mention is because in the last at least 4 or 5 weeks, I'm attending these hearings from 9 to 5 and listening back and forth to the presentations made by Manitoba Hydro and the four Cree First Nations, so the partner First Nations, and having the questions or their presentations challenged by other interveners like myself and Noah, so the grassroots individuals, as well as other First Nations. And this is something that's very raw, because seeing these hearings and attending them actually gives you a little bit of a different perspective of some of the discussions we're at, and it challenged a little bit of my thinking and perhaps the positions that I take and the choices that I make. So as I'm listening the banter back and forth between Manitoba Hydro and the co-proponents, the Cree First Nations, and the other First Nations who are opposing the project, then you have, on the one hand, the Cree perspective, so the Cree First Nations, who are strongly arguing that this project should be built. They will argue that this Kiesk project will not only provide jobs, employment, economic opportunities, but it is to them, in the form of its partnership, an example of self-determination and self-governance. So their argument is really for the project, and they're saying this is an exercise of our Aboriginal rights, is to choose to have this project on our land. Because, and some of the arguments that have been presented, is that, well, we can live off the land like we used to. There's too many of us, not enough resources. We need to progress, and this is not the way we live. This is a choice we're making. It was a very difficult choice, but indeed, we have chosen to do this, and we are pushing this to go through. On the other hand, I am seeing the other First Nations and the other interveners, as we're called, who object to this project. And their objection largely is based on, which is why I think we're all here, the environmental aspects of it. So just like my job and the other intervener's job is to challenge the environmental impact statement that Manitoba has produced, which is basically on every slide, their conclusion is that the project will have absolutely no adverse effects. And it's to the point where between all of us, we're arguing that, well, maybe they should build all these dams everywhere because apparently they don't impact anything anywhere and they bring back endangered populations. But that is one of the arguments that are presented. However, why some of the Cree First Nations are also objecting to the project is because they're relying on the idea that a true Aboriginal person or a true Cree perspective would not allow this project to go through. So hearing these and the discussions that, you know, Minapinamatisuin, which is the equivalent, I guess, of well-being and health, will be disrupted, that, you know, we believe that the lands and the harvesting continues to support us and our lifestyle up north, and that no further damage should be made. So I'm sitting here, and as I'm sitting at the hearings, each and every day for the last little while, I'm hearing back and forth, and some of the questions that were outlined for us to think about really popped up in every step of the way. So I guess some of the questions are the Kiaskri Cree Nations, as they're called now by Manitoba Hydro, ironically, allowed to have development on their lands? And are they really not Aboriginal people if they choose to have development on their lands? So in regards to the article, and I picked out just one thing, as Indigenous rights are the best defense, I would say, well, yes, if you look at individuals like, and I was going to bring my friend Noah to come here, who still relies on that land, who actually goes out and relies on the resources as subsistence. I mean, he can't walk. He has a trouble crawling and going upstairs, but he does go out and continues to go out. But yet, at the hearings, perhaps, he's seen as this, you know, old man, this kind of way of life that's slowly dying and things are changing. And it's the other younger kind of people who are speaking for this project and saying, you know, this is our self-determination. Like, you know, you're going to die. Our kids are the future. And one elder, actually, Cree elder, did speak on behalf of Manitoba Hydro and said that he has 7 children, I think, and 12 grandchildren. And this project will provide a future for them. So in regards to Indigenous rights, I think, yes, they are the best defense. If we do think of people who do rely on the resources, but perhaps that's somewhat flawed with our environmental views of how we want to view them as well and how we want to shape those perspectives. But yet, if I listen to the hearings and I think of Indigenous rights and the freedom of Indigenous people, for example, to choose, you know, equal opportunities in economy, as was discussed by other panelists, and to have opportunities to have jobs and participate and have the same things like we do, it comes at a price. And if for them that price is to have resource exploitation on their territory, because that's what they see to be, especially in Fox Lake when 4 other dams have already pretty much destroyed the ecosystem in that area, then Indigenous rights take on a different meaning. And I guess this is the context I wanted to approach this panel. It perhaps is not the right view for an environmentalist crowd, but it is something that I have been seeing, and it is something, because I'm sitting there in the back of these hearings looking at these positions back and forth, and in the end, I don't think I have any conclusions about what, you know, what that could mean and if they are the best defense. But it is definitely a subject that needs to be further discussed. So thank you very much.
We're making sure that we're not going to electrocute anyone. Thank you for that. Dr. Richard Atleo is our next and last speaker, and also one whose credentials I couldn't memorize because they are so extensive. The shortest version I can come up with is that he's currently the research liaison at the University of Manitoba, associate adjunct professor at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, a board member of the Center for Environmental Resources, and champion to the Indigenous Adult and Higher Learning Association of British Columbia. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to begin by telling you something you will find very difficult to believe, being the 21st century now, that I was born into my language and into my culture. I was not born into English, nor was I born into Canadian culture. I learned the Canadian culture through the school system, through the residential school system. Eventually got a doctorate degree, and I discovered that Indigenous knowledge is not really an Indigenous issue, nor was it created or thought up by Indigenous peoples, but it's actually a fellow by the name of Merigo Vespucci, who reported in his explorations of the New World that Indigenous peoples appeared to behave as though they were lords of themselves, which was a very new democratic idea for the Europe of that day. It was picked up by Sir Thomas More and wrote about in his Utopia. Something to think about. That's only one of the indigenous contributions to Western thought. Much of practices of ancient times has been crippled within our communities, but they still carry on to some substantive degree. For example, many of our songs were not created in the same way that Western songs are created, but were accessed through vision questing and were granted directly through a visioning process, and then sung in public, provided meaning and purpose to life through that process. That is still carried on in my community. A young man restored 25 songs in a short period of time, and these songs were recognized by elders as having been gone, and now they've come back. Well, they were never gone. They just went out of sight for a little while. But that was one of our ancient practices for knowledge acquisition, was to go on a vision quest. We call that usumch. I was born into that way. And that's the way that I knew before I went to school. And so I learned that the English language and my language are like squares and circles. They don't compute together. The translation is always distorted between the two. But I want to say that Quaouts was a name given by Chief Maquinna to Mozinho, the Spanish explorer. Because Mozinho said, "What do you call your god?" And Chief Maquinna said, "Quaouts," which means owner of that which is, literally. Owner of that which is, I belong to Quaouts, according to that definition. It provides a context of conditions about the nature of existence. Quaouts provides a context, right? And so I've discovered through my training at the university and achieving a doctorate degree, the critical analytical process of thought, which in my culture is numak, forbidden. Because critical analysis is a process of taking things apart. And in my culture, we put things together. In my culture, we always go for wholeness, for strength. We don't do things when the tide is falling or when the moon is getting smaller. We do things when the tide is rising and becoming full. When the moon, we participate. We kunush, we piggyback on the powers of nature, which we observe to be helpful, to sustain us, to help us to grow. My advisor at the University of British Columbia admitted to me that he thought I was genetically inferior. This was in the late 80s, that I wasn't capable of doing a doctorate degree. Now, where did this idea come from, of genetic inferiority? Does it come from religion? Nope. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from science, of course. Well, I learned that Darwin's original title to his book had in it favored races, which completely justified domination of other races, because those races not favored like mine were inferior and disappearing. So hence you come to a nice country like this, and the people here are inferior, and according to the scientific theory, very, very good theory at the time, right, and believed by all kinds of some of the best thinkers whose books you're still studying today at the university, like Thomas Hobbes and John Locke and many of the Enlightenment romantic thinkers. Great people, great ideas, but they also had these other ideas that were extremely, unfortunately, very destructive to my people. That's what I learned at the university. Right? I would like, though, to acknowledge this professor, because he was big enough and man enough to admit to me that this is what he thought. My dissertation was shortlisted for a national award. And I think this is maybe one reason why he apologized to me. But I do admire that character. I do admire that man who had a way of thinking about other people and then was able to confess it and say, I'm sorry, I thought you were genetically inferior, that you were not capable of doing a doctorate degree. This in 1989, in 1990. Whoa, almost the 21st century. So there are many people that have denied a lot of these things that have pretty much gone underground for the most part within the academy. For all of my active academic career, I presented indigenous knowledge to various audiences around the world, mostly in America and Europe. And it was always rejected by members of the audience in the academy. Always rejected. Why do you bother doing it? Nobody's listening. But it's not something that is a perverse kind of activity on my part. It's something I could not help doing because I was born into it. Because I grew up in a family that lived a different way of life than that which I now experience in Canadian society. And so I said, how did my people survive? And we have all of these notions that began with distortions with the first explorers, Amerigo Vespucci. And all these distortions that became the Indian Act and the residential school policy and practice and all of the practices in school. And when I met Supreme Court Justice McEachern in British Columbia, he said, I could make no other decision than that which I made. A good man, a Supreme Court Justice, an honest man, an honorable man. But his expert in indigenous knowledge was a European Enlightenment thinker, Thomas Hobbes, whom he quoted against the Delgamuukw decision in British Columbia. I could make no other, and so the reason that he could make no other decision than that which he made as a lawyer, as a Supreme Court Justice, as a learned man, is because within the curriculum of Canada, there was nothing in his training that taught him anything about indigenous peoples. Your own justice here wrote a book and said the same thing, that in his training, there was nothing about Aboriginal people in Manitoba. Thomas Berger said the same thing in British Columbia, the Chief Justice. He said there was nothing in his curriculum that taught him. And so when we went to court, there was a vacuum of information about Indigenous peoples. And then decisions were made by the courts about Indigenous peoples based on that vacuum, which was filled by Enlightenment thinkers like Thomas Hobbes, probably a very good man, right? But that doesn't help if you don't have any facts. Doesn't help if you don't have any facts. So thank you for showing up today and getting a few facts.
All right. This incredibly distinguished panel is now ready to take questions. And I'll be giving up the mic and putting it over here. And so if you can come over to the microphone to ask your questions, if that's a problem for you, please wave us down and we'll bring the microphone to you. Just as we have asked the speakers to be concise and to really be conscious of time, I'm going to ask that you do the same. Oh my, I've totally discouraged everybody. Nobody's getting up. I have about 100 questions, so if you let me, I'll just be. And you know, some of you are my students, and if you don't ask a question, I will judge you harshly. Harshly. Can you feel the pressure? Are you going to make me start? Is that it? Are you asking questions? She's like, oh, no, no, I'm just happened to be near there. Oh, do you want to actually, okay. Yeah.
Okay. We're avoiding feedback. Oh, no. Oh, you'll just have to hold it. Okay. I guess it's just a matter of don't get too close to that because it'll.
Can I stand here? Yeah. Ask my question? Yeah. Okay, I'm just wondering, Chief Nipinak, what is your response to Agnes's query about this struggle between choosing the environment and choosing economy? She was talking about in Aboriginal communities.
That's a very good consideration. I do believe that the decision always rests with communities, and communities put in leadership that are going to advance the issues that they deem to be at the center of what they'd like to achieve. You know, when we look at the four hydro communities in northern Manitoba, they're pushing for the project. They've seen the Wasquatum project go ahead. They're looking at Kiask. There's very complex negotiations happening there. It's a difficult balance when you look at the development of hydro and what you can do with hydro versus burning fossil fuels. You know, the energy in the long term, many people would believe that the energy that we're generating in northern Manitoba is eventually going to feed itself into the United States for electric cars in the future. Is that a possibility? It may be. But in terms of the economic development that's present right now with the four hydro communities, the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs hasn't been involved to any significant extent in any of those discussions whatsoever. Now, that's a political response. I've tried to engage some of the communities specifically to talk about what types of opportunities they'd like to realize out of the negotiations that they're involved in. But that is an uphill battle. A lot of those negotiations are tied and locked up into non-disclosure agreements, and it's in my opinion, a very, very tightly controlled negotiation environment informed by politics, informed by Manitoba Hydro, politics at the highest level, even beyond Canadian politics into the U.S. National Energy Security plan. So it's complex.
You can turn on my microphone. The issue is contentious, and I remember reading a story about the Cree communities in dealing with Hydro-Québec and how after the first hydro agreement went so poorly for them, why they came back to the negotiating table to negotiate a second hydro dam. And one of the elders, you know, had this to say, that they knew that hydro dams would be built, whether or not they agreed with them. There's very, you know, little evidence to say that where Indigenous communities have rejected these dams, that it's actually been effective. The key really is relationship building. And by being at the table and negotiating, at least you're working on a relationship. And the elder said, yes, you know, sometimes this relationship really sucks and it's not going well. But if you leave the room, there is no relationship. It's easy from the outside to judge these situations, but until you're actually sitting there at the table and looking at what your choices really are, I think it's important to sort of to maintain some perspective.
Can I just make a little slight announcement, actually? Since we are talking about some of the actions we can take, this is a little announcement. So Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m., there's actually public hearings for the Kiask project. So you can go up, and please do, because last time we had a hearing, only one person from up north showed up, and we stayed 2 hours, and the conclusion was that apparently the public isn't interested in sharing their views and perspectives on the Kiask project. But this Thursday is the last opportunity to actually speak and hear from the public, and you have up to 15 minutes to go up and rant or read whatever your position is, support of or rejection of the project. I prefer, you know, rejection of, but I won't sell my views here. And if you don't have the time to do that, please submit something in writing. You can submit it directly to the CEC website. And there has been, if you look on the website, there has been submissions made already. And some of them have been made by students in elementary school from like Cross Lake. And they're written literally on a napkin in handwritten notes. And they have been scanned and sent to the CEC in rejection of the project. So please do come and support those who don't want the project. Or if you have your position that you do support the project, at least speak up and participate. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. It's at the Fort Garry Hotel, 7th floor. It's a really cold room, but it's from 7 to 9 p.m.
They make it cold like that on purpose.
I think it's because we're challenging them on electricity.
Yeah, there you go. So turn that baby down. Do I have another question? Please, come on over.
Yeah, I'll stay on this side. Last weekend, a number of us were able to hear Kevin Lamoureux from, not the Liberal politician, but the member of faculty here at University of Winnipeg. Yes, he's with the Faculty of Education. And he spoke about Idle No More. And if I understood it right, and there are a number of others who heard him speak as well, he talked about how the people who initiated that movement were really initiating to some extent what Wob described is a different worldview, a different way of engaging with our land. And very quickly it became an issue that got stuck in a corner of our national identity. It became an Aboriginal movement. And those of us who are not Indigenous are wondering how we can become allies. And it sort of feels like from outside. And Wob, I heard you describe it in a way that invites us to understand the language of a different paradigm. That's the term you used. I sometimes wonder, you know, when cultures mix, they adopt each other's words. So the word kindergarten is actually a German word, but it's become one of our words. And I wonder what it would take for some of the terms you introduced us to this evening, that they'd become part of our Canadian language, even when we're speaking English. And that would be a kind of a sign that we are, in fact, sharing and learning from each other and being more than allies, but being in relationship, as you described. I don't know if you want to comment on that
sure.
at all.
Yeah. I'd start by pointing out that you're in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, which is Winnibing, Manitoba, Canada, right? So in many ways, we are hidden in plain sight as Indigenous people. Like, how did this place come to be known as the Dirty River, or this province, like where the spirit is sitting, you know, or where the spirit lives? And I don't know, forgive me, I don't know the Haudenosaunee origin of Kannada. I think it's town. Might be mistaken about that. Is that? Yeah, and why is that? Why do we have those place names, you know? And you go across the country and it's the same thing, like Saskatchewan or Ottawa or all these places, right? Or Anishinaabe or Cree or Odawa names. Odawa being the original pronunciation. Same in the States, right? Like Omaha, right on through the U.S. And the reason is because part of the project of colonialism has been to try and erase us, right? And the role that we played here. But you look at Canadian history, I mean, we've been there throughout. We've been the military allies who stopped this part of North America from falling under the control of the Americans, you know, between the Seven Years' War and the War of 1812. We were there involved with bringing many provinces into Confederation through treaty-making times. We fought in both world wars. We're, you know, valorous warriors in both of those. We were engaged in civil society through the 1960s and 70s. We helped repatriate the Constitution in 1982, and today we're ingrained in every aspect of society in North America, from the highest ranking people in sports and arts to medical doctors and lawyers to politicians, and you know, the list goes on and on and on. So I think the first point is that it's already happened to some extent, and we need to do a better job of recognizing that, and I think more importantly teaching that to young people, you know, teaching that to children, And then if we take a step back and, you know, consider the project that I guess I was calling for, which is to celebrate Indigenous worldviews and to help foster their, I guess, contributing to the global discourse that's happening right now. I think that, yeah, it starts with educating kids to understand first the history, but also to understand the cultures and what the cultures have to say today and understand who the people are, you know, because incorporating Indigenous material into the curriculum, which I'm sure Kevin Lamoureux was also advocating, you know, we know today that it benefits Indigenous students. It makes them more likely to complete education, and it also makes them less likely to have problems with substance abuse and alcohol, right? Like, there's evidence for that now. But it also benefits non-Native kids, I think, because we live in a knowledge-based economy where innovation is prized more than anything. And I would question, if that is the case, why do we try to teach everybody to think the same way? Why wouldn't we invite other ways of seeing the world, other paradigms, other ways of solving the problems into the discussion? Why wouldn't we want that for our kids to learn and to consider and to integrate into the way that they think? So yeah, I think it's awesome that, you know, you're suggesting that revitalizing Indigenous languages through incorporating them into Canadian discourse is one way to go. And then after that, you know, like, give up the second car and your house and, you know, devote all that money to Indigenous communities and their economic development in the future. No, obviously not. I'm not going to ask for that because, you know, it's never going to happen. But I do think that, you know, part of what needs to happen is what many academics call decolonization, right? And so, you know, like, as Indigenous people, we can decolonize, but also non-Indigenous people can decolonize too. And at the end of the day, decolonization for me, it's just about resetting power relationships, right? So if you approach things in a good way, and you're not coming in with the paternalistic attitude of the past or the ideology, you know, of that evidence is truth, you know, but rather that you have an open mind, then I think that you're starting from a good position. And just to add one more thing in regards to what we consider, what we think of these communities who do advocate for hydro projects and things like that. Like, I'll be honest, when I first heard about Wasquatum and stuff like that, I was like, what are you guys doing, you know? But then I remembered a very fundamental teaching that I received as a boy. I watched my old man get scolded by his mentor when we were in Alberta, in Cree territory, for trying to break down an Anishinaabe teaching in their homeland. And the moral of the story is that one of the fundamental things in our worldview is humility. And the teaching is that, who am I to go into someone else's homeland and tell them how to do things, right? And it's very simple, but I think it's a very powerful teaching that we could all benefit and learn from. And so who am I to go into, you know, Fox Lake or, you know, Split Lake or the other communities and tell them how they should conduct their affairs? Who am I to do so? Isn't it that line of thinking which got us into all these problems in the first place? That being said, I don't like sellouts. If I see somebody that I think is a sellout, I'm going to say something about it, right? So you got to balance that with the other thing that I just said. Yeah.
On that note, before I get to you, Alex, does anybody else want to quickly respond to the question of allies, for one thing?
A little thing about how with...
Is her mic on?
I guess.
Yep. Okay. Go ahead. Can you start again?
Yeah.
Okay.
But the whole I don't know more thing and how to become an ally. You know, I'm an activist myself, and I have been for even before I don't know more started. And, you know, I have gotten that question from Westerners, like, well, how can I become more involved? And I think, you know, Wob kind of said it, you know, becoming, you know, encouraging decolonization. You know, we do want to be decolonized. But as well as, I guess, educating on our own perspectives on the situation, you know, not in saying, you know, this is the only way, and realizing that our barriers are stereotypes, you know, and listen how we see ourselves and not to see stereotypes. And with that being said, I think, you know, the whole, you know, the stereotype of we're not being inferior, you know, we want to have a relationship, we want to be on the same ground, we want to be balanced as, you know, as a relation, you know. And I think that the more open-minded you are, and the more be like, okay, well, I don't fully understand that, so how can I understand that? You know, communication. You know, how can we communicate together? You know, ask, but not into like, well, what you think is wrong. That's not what I think, that's wrong. And you'll be like, well, this is how I think. How is it that you think? And is there any common ground in how we see each other? And how we see, you know, a harmonious life? I think more seeing on loving each other and having that relationship and maintaining communication and a better understanding and not being so, you know, walls on saying that this is my only perspective and this is the only perspective that's right, because there's many perspectives that, you know, I personally may be saying something that's completely different to someone else, you know, but either way, we still have some relations or bonds communicating together. And I think, you know, being more open and accepting of other perspectives and worldviews. With, you know, that's,
thank you for that. He thought I was going to carry the microphone to him.
So I'm going to preface this with a bit of So one of the teachings that I received both through books and through stories was that, and Darren, you might know this one better, and correct me if I'm wrong if I get this, but
okay.
When the original animals first came out, their flesh was spread over the land, like the beaver became the beaver clan, and the wolf became the wolf clan, and those people were descended from the flesh of those original beings, which were spread over the land. And it was a teaching about how we're trying to teach where those, each of those individual clans is more related to that animal and has a responsibility to represent that animal just as much as they do other people. And that came up from listening to, it was kind of shot back into my mind after hearing what you had to say. And I was thinking about the concept of natural democracy that Gregory Kajate talks about how one of the biggest things that we need to bring back into all political systems is not only a representation of ourselves and speaking for humanity, but is speaking for animals, speaking for phytoplankton, whatever. But I'm wondering what, I guess, the Anishinaabe perspective can bring to how can we change the politics of Manitoba to actually have a true representation of what needs to go on. Because I guess when I hear you don't go into someone's territory and tell them what to do, I think that concept came in an era when we didn't have nuclear power plants or hydro dams, which could flood multiple people's territories when one person makes a decision, right? It's like, well, if I put this nuclear plant here, this nuclear waste here, those particles can affect everyone. Like Fukushima is getting all the way to Canada, so we can't, we have to negotiate new boundaries now about what is my territory, because we're a global community. So how do we do that mindfully and respectfully, I guess, is my question.
In 20 words or not.
He gives me a hard question. I don't know if it's just for me, but if it might be for the whole panel. Okay, it's for me then. I'm sorry. with respect to going into other people's homes, I guess, is how I'd put it, and telling them what to do, is you don't do that in Anishinaabe society. It's just a big no-no. And with respect to, like, how you mentioned there's been development, like, our community, Sagging, was the very first community in First Nation community in Manitoba ever to experience the devastating effects of flooding because of hydroelectric development, as well as we were one of the first communities, again, in Manitoba to experience nuclear power development, what happens, and some of the fishes, how they ended up turning out. So what the elder said is, we're going to leave it alone for a while, and we're just going to let these developers, these newcomers, experience Onjinewin. And Onjinewin means, if you do something to the environment that hurts it, it's going to come back at you, your loved ones, your community, your entire nation. And how one of those elders said it is, we went to the shake tent and we asked, why did the residential school happen to us? What happened? What did we do? And what those spirits told them is, you hurt the animals. You broke the treaty with those animals by overhunting them during the fur trade era. And so the Anishinaabe people paid a real big price for overextending and overhunting. So we sort of have to balance development with whatever we do, something might happen to us later on.
Can I respond also, just because Alex sort of mentioned what I said also? Like, first of all, I would completely reject what Darren just said. I don't think, like, I'm sorry, but I don't think there's any sort of determinism that can explain the savagery of the residential school era. And I don't think there's anything that Anishinaabe people could have done to deserve that, especially, like, Anishinaabe children and boys and girls. So that would be the starting point of that. The first thing I would acknowledge, yes, we live in a global society, and I don't want to hive off from that, and I totally think that it's awesome that I get to participate, compete, engage with people from around the world. And I do fully, you know, make the most of that. Like, I'm an Anishinaabe kid from Ontario working for an Arabic-owned media network in the United States of America, right? It doesn't get too much more pluralistic than that. But the point of what I'm saying about the teaching about humility is that the consideration that should be given is to the people who are going to have to live with the after effects of whatever project that we're considering or whatever activity that we're considering, right? And that's who I would define as the people whose territory we're talking about, right? And I think you're right that we need to start, if we're going to indigenize contemporary thought or if we're going to contemporize indigenous thought, you know, you could debate about which approach we're actually doing, is that we would have to broaden our thinking out. And we would have to consider, you know, okay, what does a homeland mean? What is a territory, right? And so I think that you're right on the money there, especially in a globalized environment, yes. But then at the same time, the balance that needs to be struck, I guess, is because, like, in our whole worldview, it's like Matakiasin or like a Ho'endinwemaganitok, right? Like, it's all about us all being one. We're all part of the same creation. We're all relatives on the same planet. And so that's a very powerful argument on the one hand. On the other hand, there's a very realistic argument that I am not going to live in Fox Lake 50 years from now where the real impact of Kiask is going to be felt, right? So again, I think it's a process of finding a balance between those two approaches, between, yes, allowing people from around the globe to have a voice in conversations that are going to have huge environmental impacts, while at the same time perhaps finding a way to privilege the voice of those who are going to live with the long-term effects of those. And I think that what I'm suggesting is that humility should be one of the guiding principles in how to strike that balance, so that we shouldn't run in with a certain sense of entitlement and say, well, no, listen here, Kies, for First Nations, here's, you know, what you guys need to do, and here's, you know, the sort of environmental guarantees that you want, and, you know, here's the rest of how that benefit sharing agreement should look like. No, rather, I think a good approach when you're dealing with Indigenous communities is to listen before you talk, right? And so if we're going to say that, yes, we do have a concern there, or if we have a concern with what's going on in Nelsa Buktuk with the fracking and that, I think we should first go and listen, you know, and recognize that these are the people and their children and grandchildren are the ones who are going to be, you know, dealing with the after effects in a much more immediate way than we are probably over here. And so, yeah, point taken. But I still think that we should recognize that teaching as providing us with a little insight in how we might wish to proceed.
I want to thank Alex for raising an important issue, and that is the relationship with animals and the four-leggeds. And I was really, really taken with Darren's story about how the animals left, because we've experienced that. And, you know, back home on the land, I like to get out and I like to go and look for, you know, look for animals and to bring food home, you know, at least once a year, and go out onto the lake and put nets in the water and stuff like that. But, you know, one of the things that we recognized in the Duck Mountain area of Manitoba is that the moose left us. You know, the moose left. And you can point the finger at a lot of different things that happened in the Duck Mountain area. You can point the finger at Louisiana Pacific that opened up the entire mountain to quads and trucks and easy access to go and pick off moose and to devastate the stock. You can also blame some sort of brain worm disease or something, and wood ticks, and you can blame all kinds of, you can take Western science and you can decide for yourself what happened. But the bottom line is that the moose left the mountain and they moved into a southwestern direction away from where the heaviest pressure from hunting was coming. And you know, we recognized that as Anishinaabe people a few years ago already, that the stock was leaving us, and we talked to a lot of people. I myself talked to Wob's late dad about it, and I said, I think that the moose are leaving us. I think that they're leaving the mountain, and they won't come back because we've killed too many of them. You know, that's the bottom line. And, you know, I look at outside influence as well. You know, the province of Manitoba, through conservation, has created a patchwork of different hunting zones. And they say, you can hunt over here this year, but you can't hunt over there. You can hunt over here, but you can't hunt over there. And we're going to give Americans tags to come up and take out a certain number of moose this year, even though they really don't know how many moose there are anyway. They only work with paper numbers on paper. We saw that happen with the moose, but we also saw that happen with the fish. And the science is manipulated to create policy at government levels, which that policy is then used to prevent Indigenous people from going out onto the land and doing the things that we've always done. But on our side of the table as well, we have to reconceptualize what we mean when we talk about a treaty right to hunt, because the actual exercise of managing your ecosystem, the very last thing you do is take an animal off the land. That's the very last thing you do in ensuring that there is a treaty right to hunt. There are so many different steps along the way before you actually arrive at a point where you can pull the trigger and take meat home to your family. You have to maintain the ecosystem first and foremost, and that means that there's a stock there for future generations. We've gotten into this mentality that we have an entitlement to go and kill five moose in Saskatchewan, or five moose on the hill and bring all that food home, because we're great hunters. It's not hard to pull a trigger on a gun and take down a moose. It's very easy to do, actually. You know, but we've got this sense of entitlement now. And I don't know where it comes from. I sometimes think that it might be the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, where people take on these, I have rights to say what I want to say. Well, I have rights to go and move over there. I have rights to do whatever I want. When in fact you have obligations and responsibilities to your children, your grandchildren, and those future generations. You know, I think that we've gotten away from that. You know, and when I talk about treaty rights, I talk about treaty rights to hunting, and I talk about treaty rights to education and so forth. I first and foremost recognize my responsibility as a sovereign person. I have a treaty right to education, true, but what do I bring back to my community after exercising that treaty right to education? What can I contribute to my family's well-being and my community's well-being? Well, I'm doing it. I'm the Grand Chief of AMC. I was the chief of my community. I've given back to my community because they gave to me, put me in a good position. And the same holds true with how we treat the animals on the land. We have to get back to understanding our obligations and responsibilities to them, and we're not doing that effectively. And we can't just point the finger at one another. We've all got to recognize what we've done. Miigwech.
Cool. On that note, we'll be wrapping up the evening. Thank you to the panelists. I'll be handing over the microphone to Alana here in a moment, if you'll just hang on. Thank you.
Okay, I am going to make a round of thank yous, but I feel obligated, given the subject tonight, to mention one workshop in particular tomorrow. Tomorrow is sort of the skills focused day, so there's workshops starting at 10 in the morning and they go all the way through into the nighttime. But there's one that I thought of a few times as people were asking questions and responding to questions, and it's a workshop that's happening tomorrow morning from 10 a.m. until noon in room 2C11, so 10 a.m. until noon until 2C, 10 a.m. until noon in 2C11. And Leslie Spillett, Gladys Rowe, Michael Hart, Lisa Stepnuck, and Liz Carlson are going to be leading a workshop to help everyone there strengthen our abilities to talk about colonialism and racism with the people in our lives. So if you're looking forward to Christmas dinner, for example, go to the workshop first. It's going to be really interesting, I think, and everyone's welcome as always, so please come. But with that said, I wanted to get that out before I forgot. And there are handbills out front with a full schedule of events for the week. And there's a photo contest happening all week as well. So check out the table out front and our website for details. But I also want to just have everyone join me in again thanking all of our speakers. It's been an incredible privilege to have such a wonderful group of people here, and to thank Julie for moderating. I also want to thank Chris, who's been doing sound out back. There's Chris. Thank you, Chris. And can everyone who's involved in Grassroots this year stand up? I know a lot of people I watched them sneak out because they were preparing. But I'm looking at two of them right now not standing. So Andre and Fraser. Luke and Peter and Teresa, where are you? There's Teresa. Teresa's there. Luke and Peter escaped somewhere. Okay. Well, it's a privilege to work with the UWSA and Ecopia and GISA every year on this festival. It's the highlight of my year because I'm so inspired by these folks. So I want you to join me in thanking them and our panelists and Julie, and I hope to see you more this week. Have a great night.